In today's conversation, I sit down on campus with Brendan Samuels, a passionate grassroots conservationist, PhD student, and empathetic thinker. Brendan has been making grassroots changes in the city of London, Ontario, by garnering support from a variety of groups, transcending boundaries through an empathetic and creative approach. Our conversation covers how his backyard project has expanded to a global scale, how to approach people and spark change, how change is made not only through grassroots approaches, but from a top-down approach, and the overall importance of positive community engagement and small-scale actions in driving larger environmental conservation efforts. Brendan's approach to promoting change in the local community is a refreshing perspective in today's media climate. His ability to promote cooperation through critically thinking and empathizing among groups holding different perspectives is tactful and genuine. I was very happy to sit down with Brendan and discuss all that he had to say. I'm still thinking about it, and I hope that you are able to take something away from this conversation as well. I think there's a lot of meaning within it. Thanks for tuning in today's episode, and as always, enjoy the conversation. Brendan, thanks for being here. I really appreciate it and your time. I'm excited to talk about how to garner local support, different community groups, how to advocate, and really how to build kind of the backing that you've built here in London for bird safety and bird safe windows and everything that you've done, especially it seems as such a young person to be able to do that and have such a passion for it too. You know, you kind of caused a ruckus in the local, I say, bylaw world, you know, and very cool to see that things can be done on a local level and how they affect day-to-day life within the city.
Yeah, happy to be here. That's glowing praise. I usually feel like I don't know what I'm doing, just stumbling around and figuring it out. But certainly we've made some progress in London and happy always to share lessons learned and mistakes made along the way.
So you came and talked to our class and gave some really hilarious, I think, stories on some of the actions you've taken. I would like to touch on one, or for you to retell one about the cats.
Oh, yeah.
The birds. Because I, not only is it funny and it's genius, like it's the way that you maneuvered away, the way that you maneuvered around the issue instead of coming to a head and being opposing to it, you were able to reframe the situation and come from an allied perspective and use that knowledge to prevent loose cats. And I think to be able to do that in more situations in life where we want to see change should be more common. And by going at it head to head, it causes more conflicts. Mm-hmm. So could you talk about that and your solution and how you got to
that space? All right. So how do I approach this? First, maybe I'll start just explaining what the project is and the rationale for creating it and my thinking about it. So I, like a lot of people, have a backyard. I'm privileged to enjoy maintaining green space. And I, for a time, also had bird feeders set up. I study birds, and so I'm interested in watching what they do and how they experience the world. And like a lot of people with bird feeders, I realized that there was a risk of people letting their pet cats roam outside, come over to my yard, and hunting birds. And that didn't sit right with me because I felt like I was artificially drawing them, all these birds, closer to my home and then putting them at risk. But what do you do in that situation? I didn't know exactly who owned the cats I was seeing. They were pretty obviously pets. Sometimes you come across cats outside that are feral and just live off of the street. These ones were well-fed and you could tell they belonged to someone. But how do you reconcile that? I mean, we live in a society where with pet dogs, you wouldn't let your dog run around a neighborhood off-leash. That's not normalized anymore. But with cats, that's just something a lot of people have accepted as part of a cat's day-to-day life. And of course, there's a lot of risks that that entails, not just for birds, but for the cats themselves, being hit by cars, being eaten by coyotes, ingesting rat poison, fights with other cats and raccoons. And I could go on. It's a long list. And I like cats personally. I mean, a lot of people meet me and they go, oh, you're a bird person. I can't talk to you about my cat. I do like cats. I think the issues with cats and birds, which are significant because of bird population declines being exacerbated by cats, are not the fault of the cats. They're the fault of people not recognizing a responsibility for what they're doing with their pets. It's their decision to let their cat roam outside. Anyway, so I had these cats visiting my bird feeder, and one day I'm like, I need like a message in a bottle. I wish I could like put a message in a glass bottle and like throw it into the sea, knowing that like someone would pick it up, the right person, and read it and understand and receive the message. And I had this idea that I could create a message in a bottle and actually attach it to the cat so that when the cat went home, it would be carrying the message to its owner. So I went out and bought a bunch of what we call safety release cat collars. So they're brightly colored cat collars. You can buy them in bulk on Amazon or Walmart. And if you just tug on them, they break off pretty easily. So I bought a bunch of those. And then I bought some keychain tags with paper inserts. And I replaced those inserts with little QR codes that I printed, just regular paper. I made those QR codes to link to a letter that I wrote. And the letter I put on my Google Drive, and it's a letter to the owner of a pet cat. I wrote it to be generic, so it's not to a particular person. It is specific to London. It has some locally applicable information about our bylaws and risks. But what's kind of important about the letter is that it's written in a way that is meant to appeal to the values of the pet owner. As in, I'm not going on about birds. I'm starting by talking about, I'm really concerned for your pet's well-being. How would you feel if your cat did not come home? Here are examples of risks to cats in London. Here's what the law says. Here are organizations that are seen as really credible about animal and pet welfare that advise against this. And importantly also, here are ways that you can continue to take your cat outside without putting them at risk. Because I actually think, you know, people will say, oh, all cats need to be indoors. I don't agree with that. I think cats are animals. They like being outside. It's good for them. But they need to be contained when outside. So we have to educate people that you can build an enclosure for your cat. You can train your cat to wear a leash. You can put them in a basket or a backpack and go for a walk with them, a stroller. There's all kinds of options, recognizing that some cats are a bit stubborn. You can't always train them so easily. And so putting all this information in an anonymous, neighborly, friendly letter and sending it home with the cat. Now, as with any message in a bottle, the author does not have a perspective on how the reader, the recipient of the letter, is going to react. When I tested this in my neighborhood on a cat that had lived a few doors down, I found that the cat stopped visiting, and I actually spotted it a few weeks later in a window wearing a collar. So I think I may have spooked the owner a little bit. So creating that tool, we designed it in a way that I wanted it to be accessible to anyone. So it's on our website, birdfriendlylondon.ca/education, and people can go and print their own. They can customize it. There's instructions on how to create the QR code. And my understanding is that this has been adapted and is being used in other parts of the world, in other languages.
That's amazing. That's fantastic. And this was a personal project.
It was a personal project. Yeah. So I am involved with a group called Bird Friendly Cities. London, Ontario is participating in this program by Nature Canada. The Bird Friendly City program, I think, has something like 24 different communities across the country participating now. And they basically certify participating municipalities for how bird friendly they are. They have to meet certain criteria to do with habitat protection, mitigating threats to birds, and community engagement and awareness, etc. So I developed this as part of that program because in London we have bird populations in need of protection. Cats predating birds are one of the major threats. And so this was a simple solution that we could put out there into the community and have people adopt it as they need it.
That's so cool to be able to bring a personal project literally in your backyard, your own backyard, and now it's across the globe and used in other cities, as well as to influence bird-friendly cities and have this resource for, you said, 24 cities across Canada.
Yeah, all of the things that we produce in London are meant to be shared. So that's not just cat-related things. It's all of the other threats to birds. It's messaging for how to talk to your neighbor. And being part of this network, which is in Canada, but they have a similar program, Bird City Network, in the United States and South America. It aligns all of these people who care about birds, who are working in maybe different geographic spaces, but can benefit from common tools. We don't mm-hmm. have to reinvent the wheel everywhere.
Yeah. To be able to share that and to realize that too, that tools, especially as cats are everywhere, mm-hmm. essentially the same tool to mitigate that should be able to be used everywhere as well.
I think so. I mean, a lot of these conversations do happen at a local level, and I'm quite interested in municipal frameworks for dealing with environmental degradation. I think a lot of responsibility for environmental protection has been downloaded from higher levels of government to municipalities, and recognizing that every city or every town is different, the cultural context is important to consider. A tool that we develop for use in London might not work so well if you're looking at, I don't know, a city in Mexico or in the southern United States. There's values that interplay. There's applicable legislation like bylaws. There's availability of solutions. There's a lot of dimensions to it. So I try not to be too prescriptive in saying this is how these solutions need to be everywhere. It's more about like, how do we reconcile differences in values and opinion across people? And I think there are some general principles that are useful to think about.
Yeah. How long did it take you to develop this from when you, I guess, hatched the idea, or when you saw the cat maybe the first time, and then you hatched the idea and it came to fruition?
I think it was a couple of months. I work iteratively. So I came up with a draft version. What I love about being in the academic space I'm in is that I have a network of people that care about a lot of the same things, and we often will share ideas in draft form for feedback. And so I sent this letter to some folks I trust, and I said, what do you think? Like, does this read well? Can you imagine reading this as a pet owner that might not care about birds the way that we do, but who cares about their cat? I sent it to some cat people, and their feedback helped to soften the language, to make sure that we were framing things in a way that would resonate. So the letter that is now available has been tweaked a couple of times, but yeah, it didn't really take long. And we have other letters at that same website I mentioned earlier that are meant to help facilitate difficult conversations with neighbors. So I mentioned cats, but there's a number of other things that people unknowingly will do that can create issues for wildlife. And it's not always easy to go and talk to them and say, hey, can you maybe stop raking your leaves? Like, do you really need to get every single leaf in a bag? Or I noticed that you're putting up plastic spider webs everywhere, and those actually are a major entanglement hazard and source of microplastics. You don't want to be the person who's, you know, trespassing and wagging your finger at someone. But what we thought might help is if you could anonymously share information just so that they know, so that next time they get to make a choice about whether to maybe save some of the leaves or delay until the pollinators have emerged from overwintering, or maybe they're at Halloween season and they're shopping for decorations, they'll have that knowledge in back of mind, like, oh, someone in my community is paying attention to what I'm doing, and I'm aware that the harms are there. Maybe I'll choose a little different this time. Mm-hmm. So it's that like community, I don't want to call it surveillance, I don't like that word, but it emphasizes that there are people in the community who care and are monitoring, and it fosters the sense of collective good.
Yeah. Well, when you know, you ultimately end up caring in a sense, and recognizing that there are issues with it. And I think most people just maybe don't know, and by bringing that awareness, because they might care just as much as you, they just don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, I struggle with that. I force myself to give people the benefit of the doubt, because as you put it, people don't know. So I don't think we get anywhere by assuming that people have bad intentions. You have to start from a point of they don't necessarily have the same access to knowledge that I do. Maybe no one has ever explained this to them. Maybe they've never had an opportunity to see the harms that are being caused if they're removed from it. I think empowering people with knowledge is a very important starting point to building bridges and fixing things. If you skip that step and you just assume that they're out to cause harm or they're selfish or they don't care, it's much more difficult to use a positive affiliative approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, especially because if someone came up to me and assumed that I was doing something wrong and, you know, came at me with not with a perspective that I didn't know, but that I was intentionally doing something wrong, I would automatically get defensive, right? And then that's where I think a lot of issues stem from today, is we don't give people the benefit of the doubt, and therefore we're already have an offensive and a defensive, and this is not, we're not playing a game. We're trying to, you know, share something with someone else, but we approach it from just that totally wrong way.
Yeah, I agree with that. We're all kind of in this perpetual, I don't know, fight or flight mode. Everyone is struggling, defending, trying to get by. And our world is just so complicated, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that we learn that I think are not because we've given it a whole lot of thought. It's just we exist in these really complicated systems and we adopt behavioral norms that we see modeled in things like media. I mean, my earliest exposure to the notion of cats roaming outside came from watching cartoons where the cats roamed outside and that was an okay thing to do. Yeah. People learn to fear snakes because the snakes in Disney movies are scary and evil. And so these things get learned, and it's actually really challenging for people to unlearn that stuff because they've internalized the narrative. And until you give them pause to think about the secondary harms or the implications or unintended consequences of that narrative, then they're just in default mode. They're just surviving. And people becoming defensive, once that happens, it's much harder to break the barrier of opening them up to unlearning. So I think presenting information in the right way is very, very important for conservation purposes. I often hear the word conservation management thrown around. And a lot of people assume that, you know, what is to manage conservation? Well, it's taking care of green space and managing species at risk. And that's certainly part of it. But I think the bigger piece is managing ourselves, that the biggest threats to the natural world are stemming from people and what we do, especially in our current culture of freedom on steroids. We need to think about managing human behavior and choices at a systems level so that we can achieve the conservation. And framing and information flow is a big part of that.
Yeah. You have a huge depth of knowledge of, like, you've obviously thought about this a lot, more so than anyone else I've talked to. You come at it from a very, I guess, social perspective of putting yourself in someone else's shoes, and seems like you do have lots of experience in this. So, like, how did you get into caring about not only conservation, because I care about conservation, but you come at it from social perspective almost, where you're facilitating change. You know? Mm-hmm. You're able to make change and you're doing that at the local level. Whereas I think when I think about conservation, I want to contribute to the way that it's going. Like, I want to join someone or some organization and help promote the conservation that they're doing. Mm-hmm. Whereas you are looking at systemic issues or things that should be changed. And so how did you, I guess, come to take that perspective? Because it seems unique to me.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. I don't consider myself super unique because I know a lot of people that are interested in a lot of the same things, and I learn from walking in their footsteps. I would say for most conservation issues today, we need a combination of top-down and bottom-up facilitation. So what I mean by that is we need regulatory enforcement. We need people at the highest levels of society to decide this is important and we're going to change the rules and make it better. We also need people at the grassroots level to be pushing up and applying pressure, not just on those decision makers, but on others in their communities so that we gain momentum and this just becomes normalized. When I look back in time at the successes that were found with social movements to drive change, they often began with grassroots origins. It was people who got together and strategized about this is like a problem and we want to change it. We want to fix it. And there are different ways to do it. There's different policy levers that can be pulled. A lot of it comes down to timing, very situational. Where I sit, I'm kind of I'm very privileged to have the opportunity to interact with the top-down and the bottom-up pieces. So looking at like a governance approach to dealing with, you know, bylaws and the building code and that sort of thing, I get to work with people on the inside of those systems and learn more about them and figure out how we can actually drive change. At the same time, from the grassroots level, it's really important to make sure that people are aware that when we vote, we get to decide what happens after the election, as in we actually have a lot more autonomy to shape our society than people realize. I mean, I could rant on and on about the importance of civic engagement and elections and getting people to vote and take it seriously. But I think from my point of view, the top down and bottom up go together. I also find it to be kind of a personal challenge for me because ultimately this is about changing minds and hearts. So it's not just enough to tell people, here's the facts. You have to get them to care, give them a reason to care. And with that, you're dealing with the unlearning piece, but there's also emotional components and there's no cookie cutter that fits everyone, right? People are coming from different backgrounds and places, things that they just have lived experience with that they're being asked to kind of park or unpack, and that can be difficult work. So I see it as a personal challenge to try to empathize with people I disagree with. And I think if more people in our politics did that, we would be a lot further along in addressing the problems of society. Everyone is so divided and we're really descending into this tribalistic landscape of I think this way, you think that way, we cannot find common ground. I think if we went back to basics and said, what do we both care about? And what are things I'm willing to compromise on? How can I tell my story in a way that you're actually going to hear and understand and appreciate? And in the current cultural context, there's this sort of left and right divide on a lot of conservation issues that I think is a bit of a silly binary. I also think there's a generational divide. There are people who are younger and recognize that this is a crisis point. There are older people who tend to have accumulated more wealth that are fearful of the disruption that changing regulations could cause. How do we bridge those perspectives? I don't know. It's a fun challenge that I entertain.
Fun and huge.
It is really big. Yeah.
It's huge.
And I can't say I'm, you know, necessarily succeeding at it, but it's what motivates me. Like, it's fascinating. And I think building that community of people who care requires us to get outside of our echo chambers and our bubbles and find other people who we can also learn from.
Yeah. How, once again, this is a whole another mindset that is, I think it's very unique because it's not every day. I feel like the tribalism is so widespread and maybe under our radars, you know, like we don't recognize that we are indeed tribalistic in that way. But how did you, I guess, recognize this tribalism and give like a book you've read, like the empathy of being, because the position you're coming from is, like I would say, unique and it's very uncommon. It's easy for people to say, this is my tribe. I am me and you are you, and we're different. And that, I think that may be human nature, but you're trying to bring people together. And obviously that's a challenge, especially in today's climate. And so were you just naturally trying to do this? Do you have a resource or a book or something that you read and something just clicked?
That's a good question. I mean, I've read a bunch of things. I can't think of one in particular that sort of got me thinking along these lines. Maybe it'll come back to me.
Yeah.
I think, though, I took an interest in just, I guess, geopolitics before I started grad school, paying attention to, you know, elections at the federal level in Canada and in the United States and beyond. I have family overseas and there's a lot of political upheaval there today, but historically, you know, their livelihoods depend on who's in power. I think the parts of tribalism in our politics that frustrate me the most are the kind of aestheticization of politics. So it's where we're taking political positions on issues and we're removing the substance from those debates and we're focusing more on the optics. We're thinking more about how does this look? How many votes is this going to get me? How does this resonate with the base? And what I see in our politics, especially provincially and federally today in Canada, is a departure from merit or ethical-based decision-making towards how do we just hold power? Like, what is it going to take? And that really scares me and it frustrates me. That is fueled by our outdated electoral process. It is the imperative for these political camps, these parties, to get reelected. And they can form majority governments like we have in Ontario that can basically act as authoritarian regimes unchecked. And this is a crisis that we need to think about really carefully, because the culture of tribalism, I think, stems from the way that power flows through society over time. And until we achieve reforms to our elections, we are going to be stuck in an endless loop of people just talking to folks that agree with them and modeling the aesthetics of caring instead of doing the work.
Mm-hmm. And it is, I think once you say that, it is easy to recognize it. I do see that there's a lack of merit, and it is, what does it take to stay in power? And it's not necessarily the decision that best benefits the most amount of people. So how does, unfortunately, it seems like natural resources, and I don't really like to use the word natural resources because we realize that we are considering the natural world as a resource for extraction. Do you have an alternative term for that?
So there's different ways to conceptualize it. It's kind of depending on the context and what you mean. I sometimes use the term natural resources because it has a legal definition. Mm-hmm. So we have a Ministry of Natural Resources, and it immediately, it's part of that empathy piece, right? Like, if you're talking to people whose entire worldview is based on extractivism, then you need to use that language to have a conversation with them, even if you don't personally agree with it. I think if you're talking to Indigenous peoples, they have different language to describe things we call natural resources, like relatives. An animal, a deer that you hunt, is also a relative. It's not just a commodity. So I think language is important, but I also think we have to kind of use it to meet people where they're at. I like the term biodiversity or natural heritage. Biodiversity is kind of a technical term that we use to describe all living things on the planet. And so I think it's a bit of a catch-all, but like climate change, I think it's one of those words that can resonate in people's minds for its simplicity. It fits in most contexts. Natural heritage is another one that we use. In London, for example, we have a natural heritage system. The word heritage implies inheritance. So it's, what are we taking from the past and leaving for future generations? Adopting that longer window and thinking about our actions. I think that's important as well, because ultimately the flow of how we use resources over time shapes the health of ecosystems and the sustainability of it all. Yeah, so those are two concepts that might be helpful.
Okay. Yeah, I was looking for a term to replace natural resources, because I recognize that when I say it affects our natural resources, my intention isn't for everything that is natural to be a resource. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the term maybe biodiversity or natural heritage.
I've also heard the term like wealth used. If you think about it, like, most of the world's wealth is derived natural resources. Even fossil fuels are a natural forming commodity. Mm-hmm. Land, fresh water, timber, these are all wealth. And so, when we use the word wealth, that has economic implications. We usually think about it in terms of dollar amounts. The wealth of the landscape of Canada is something that we don't own, doesn't belong to us, but wealth also implies a certain ownership element. So that might be a little bit tricky.
Yeah, no, it does. It makes me think it's a commodity. The wealth of the landscape. But to also present that to someone who does speak the natural resources language and say, the wealth of the landscape is deteriorating. You're like, oh, we're losing money.
Right.
You're like, oh, well, that's just like a light switch on.
Right.
That's a great way to approach it.
People think about, the riches of Canada's landscape. It's interesting. I've been following the Ontario Liberal Party has been sort of gearing up to combat our current government in the next election. And a word that they keep using over and over again is abundance. They want to be perceived as a party whose platform is aligned with abundance. And I think that framing is really useful because they are trying to get at people who are struggling and who don't have access to wealth, but who want it. And abundance has those connotations. So I think there are lots of ways you can see this kind of framing being used practically in the world.
It's to see natural resources, biodiversity, wealth, politicized. And then I really think after it's politicized, it takes a backseat and it's a second thought to everything.
Yeah.
Unfortunate.
It is really frustrating. There's not going to be a mainstream discussion about natural resources in an upcoming election. I think there should be. We hear a lot about climate change, as we should, but we also have a concurrent biodiversity crisis, which stems from the mismanagement of resources.
Yeah.
And those two, climate change and biodiversity loss, are fundamentally linked. We cannot solve one without solving the other. But climate change, we have a clearer set of narratives around now. Biodiversity requires us to take a look at all of our systems and make adjustments to turn off the tap of, I guess, overconsumption. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's not reflected in our political discourse in the way that it should be. I do think that progress is made at different scales. So at the local level, there's a lot more discussion about biodiversity. I'm hearing in municipalities, cities like London, Hamilton now has a biodiversity action plan. The city of Toronto is doing things about biodiversity. At the federal government, there's discussions about biodiversity, and we have international agreements now, like COP15, that set targets for protecting biodiversity. So it's not all bad news. It's just not mainstream.
Yeah. And you mentioned that London, Hamilton, Toronto all have these biodiversity plans, yet these are metropolitan areas of, the smallest one is over 500,000 people. Toronto is over, I don't know, millions. And Hamilton's in the GTA, which contains 30% of Canada's population, mm-hmm. right? Like, these are huge urban centers.
Yeah.
So do you know how they focus on biodiversity? Because it seems by housing that many people, there's automatically a lack of biodiversity due to all the human infrastructure.
Yeah, interesting question. There's whole fields of study dedicated to this. We often hear it called urban ecology. So I may have misspoken. The City of London does not actually have a biodiversity plan. I think we should.
Yeah.
We have a lot of initiatives that are really conducive to supporting biodiversity. It's part of why we're a high-ranking bird-friendly city. We do have our natural heritage system I mentioned earlier. And there are other ways that biodiversity are reflected in our city's plans and strategies. Our official plan has a whole list of environmental policies that reference biodiversity. Hamilton has an official biodiversity plan. Toronto has one. In my experience navigating the world of municipal planning, so much depends on how these individual components, like a biodiversity plan or London's Climate Emergency Action Plan, depends on how they interface with other parts of the city. So all the different divisions of your local government, all of the other related plans and strategies, be it for zoning or transportation or growth, it all needs to fit together. And that is a big challenge I see. Municipalities have become burdensome to manage. They're really complicated.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of legacy systems in place that create unnecessary barriers. And I guess there's a word, I remember it off the top of my head, but just like extra stuff, like extra red tape is sometimes what it's referred to. But really, it's just getting biodiversity integrated into decision making at every level. And that's hard. I also think there's some divide about the importance of urban ecology. Some people think we need to really focus on preserving wilderness land, which I agree is important. So that's up in the boreal forest. That's natural areas that can be preserved and sort of insulated from human influence as much as possible. On the flip side of that, you've got biodiversity that's present where people live. So in our backyards, our street trees, our urban parks, and these features face a lot of pressure. There's a lot of stress that's caused by interactions with humans and land use and light pollution and off-leash dogs and, like, you name it, pesticides, road salts. And so we need to think about managing those systems kind of separately because they have different material needs. The other thing I think a lot about is like, where are these human population centers located? Often they're found on some of the most fertile, ecologically significant parts of the continent. We're in the Carolinian Life Zone in Southern Ontario, and we have more species biodiversity here than pretty much anywhere else in Canada. We also have a freshwater river that runs right through the city of London. The city of Toronto is right on the lakeshore. And that means there's going to be naturally occurring populations of wildlife that live there year round or are migrating through. And we need to account for that in our planning. So thinking about corridors that these animals can pass through so they're not crossing highways, thinking about where birds fly and hazards that we put in their way, like glass on buildings and light pollution. So I think it's about strategizing on protecting wilderness land, but mitigating threats from the urban environment. We need to do both of those, and we need to do them yesterday.
Yeah. I like that you mentioned that there's so much to be involved with in the urban environment, because my background and my perspective, urban is urban and wild is wild, and they're mutually exclusive, right? But mm-hmm. The living within London has great opportunities for ESAs. Mm-hmm. I've really enjoyed going to explore those, because to leave London and go find a large natural area, which is my preference, requires a 3-hour drive, and I'm not able to do that mm-hmm. very much. And so in order to, I guess, get my nature fix, I like to go to an ESA.
Yep.
And they are all over, it seems like, and they're more or less connected. There's also, on a side note, there's like great opportunities to make a trail if there was bridges over the river and then connect all the ESAs. I think that'd be wonderful. But
we do have that to an extent. We've got the Thames Valley Parkway, and there are connections throughout the city. It could be better. But I think you raised a really important point with the notion of a nature fix. And I didn't really talk about this, but an aspect of thinking about biodiversity in cities is the impacts to human well-being and human health.
Yeah.
It's not just a nature fix. We actually need to feel connected to our environments. We are not separate from nature. We are mm-hmm. part of the ecosystem. And when people are deprived of access to green space, there are negative consequences for human health and well-being. And so when we are talking about integrating green space into our cities, be that through our ESAs or where we plant trees or letting people grow pollinator gardens in their yards, there are intersections with human well-being that need to be thought through very carefully. I think we can have both. I think we can restore habitat in the urban environment, mitigate as much harm as possible, and also make our cities more livable. Folks want to live and work and invest in places that are livable and enjoyable to be in. And by having more of that green space be protected, it also has the secondary benefit of mitigating some of the harmful effects of climate change, like overheating and flooding. So there's a lot of co-benefits and interplays between these societal needs right now. I'm a big advocate for nature-based solutions because I think they're one of the most economical ways that we can adapt and prepare ourselves for more extreme conditions that are coming. A tree that we plant today is not going to bear fruit for quite a few years, but when it does, we'll be grateful for the effort.
Yeah. Yeah. To, as you mentioned, to have the co-benefits of nature and the solutions, or I guess the mitigation of flooding or extreme heat and mental well-being of people, or I guess health of people in the public. Mm-hmm. Like, I personally notice if I don't go outside and get on like a muddy trail for a period of a couple of weeks, I'll be upset. Mm-hmm. And I'll just find myself upset, and then I'll go on a walk and be out there for a couple hours and just be like, oh, just washes away.
Yep.
It's amazing. And yeah, very thankful that London has those. And then I live close to one and I'm able to go do that.
It's one of my favorite parts of living in London too.
Yeah.
I have visited every single ESA, and I know the folks that are responsible for managing the ESAs. They're the Upper Thames River Conservation Authority. They have a contract with the City of London. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of issues with those ESAs. There's a lot of difficulties that come from the public not having access to knowledge. Some people don't care, but I think the bigger problem is we're a very fast growing city. We're attracting people from all over the world who have different attitudes and assumptions about what is okay to do in those spaces. And also for properties around the ESAs, like these are integrated into the built environment. So people's homes and their backyards, but a natural area. And we see things like people dumping their yard waste, which has invasive species in it, runoff of, you know, fertilizers and pesticides from people's yards, people letting their cats outside, which we already talk about, you know, it's just a beeline right into bird habitat. And so how do we communicate that in a way that is going to land and make those people care? I think, you know, if you walk around the city right now, we have a lot of signs up that say, well, don't do this and don't do that. And this is what the bylaw says, and it's prohibited, and watch out for ticks and watch out for coyotes, and really like negative framing. What I've seen be used more recently by the conservation authority is positive messaging. So things like most of the community chooses to stay on the managed trail.
Yeah.
And please join them to protect the biodiversity of this area. And then just list a couple of things you're asking people to do. Keep your pet on a leash and watch for where you're stepping. I think that simplified positive messaging can go a long way. It also needs to be communicated using visuals and not just English, because we're a multicultural city and not everybody here can understand English in print. So you have to account for that as well.
Yeah. Well, I think what you're doing is going to help a lot. Do you plan to stay in London after you
finish your course? I hope so. I'm currently in London for school. I plan to stay living here. I need to find work that will allow me to stay.
Yeah.
I come from the Greater Toronto area. I grew up in a subdivision, and I think I appreciate London more because of my background and kind of growing up in an urban sprawl landscape. I think London just has a lot more character. It's much more livable. And so, yeah, I really hope to stay. Something I wish more people who come to Western for school or Fanshawe or the affiliates, I wish people would like go outside their campus bubble and like lay down roots almost. Not to say you have to permanently stay here, but have a relationship with where you live. Like care about London and understand it and invest in it so that people who might live here after you enjoy the benefits of like your time here. And so I'm a big advocate for students to engage and just appreciate where we are.
Yeah. Well, I think you're doing great things, making great strides in that way because of the bird friendliness promotion within the city. Also, I know we didn't touch on it, but planting your own native pollinator garden.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a whole other story, but that's you may have seen great headway there too. And I think that's very important because lawns are, I think they're outdated, to say the least.
Yeah, I agree. At the same time, though, something I've learned, and it goes back to that empathy piece, we need to be very clear that we are not out to destroy people's lawns. If they want a lawn on their land, you do you. Like, that's okay. Maybe consider shrinking it a little bit, especially if you're thinking about, you know, conserving water and that sort of thing. But we have to be very careful of this perception that we're taking away stuff from people. Folks will become defensive. Yeah. But yes, in naturalizing my yard, that word naturalized is also kind of funny. It's not natural per se. I planted it. It's in a city. It's pretty artificial, but lots of native species and habitat. That has been one of my favorite aspects of the outreach work I do in the city, because we've empowered a lot of people, I think, to take similar action. And I always say, like, if you do something good yourself, be it planting a tree or training your cat to wear a leash, you can greatly expand the impact of what you're doing by communicating it and sharing it. It could be on your social media. It could be talking to your family. It could be sharing knowledge with someone who's going through something similar. Because if they adopt it, you doubled your impact, right?
True.
And so a lot of the work we do really emphasizes just making it accessible and sharing it and celebrating it.
Yeah. I think you're a model citizen, to say the least.
I don't know about that.
I mean, you're making positive changes that not only benefits nature, but benefits society. And, you know, you're able to dance around tribes and be able to connect them in ways that is just hard. Like, even I just said, you know, like the naturalization of a yard, you know, I think lawns are outdated. And you're like, wait, you know, you got to take a step back and say, you know, you can't take that away because it's defensive. And that's just automatically what I do. And I don't even recognize it. It's definitely something I have to work on.
I'll be honest. I would love to get rid of all the lawns. Like, that is totally my vibe.
Yeah.
But yeah, you have to be prepared to compromise and just, mm-hmm. yeah, it's something I've had to learn. I mean, I've stuck my foot in my mouth many times. I'm quite outspoken on social media, not a fan of our current provincial government. And, you know, that doesn't mean I'm not willing to talk to them.
Yeah.
I mean, we can't find common ground, but I also don't want to just offend them by the language that I choose. So we can't even have a conversation in the first place.
Yeah.
It's just about, I guess, catching yourself in the moment and trying to reframe and think about it from another person's point of view.
Yeah, which is all the more important these days.
It's hard.
Yeah, it is hard. It definitely is hard. So we've almost come to our time here. I have a few questions at the end that I would like to ask.
Yeah,
you.
Sure, please.
Is there anything I should have asked you but didn't? Or is there anything else that you wanted to add on to today?
So I've been asked recently by people, like, how do you keep doing this? Like, don't you lose hope? Like, things are getting worse. Are you an optimist? Are you a pessimist? Like, what do we do with that? I have good days and I have bad days. And I think anyone who's taking on this work, don't try to do the whole thing at once, right? Like, don't burden yourself with the world's problems. Pick something in your immediate surrounding that you can control and focus on that. And even if you make just one small change and you communicate it, and then you go take a break, come back, do something else, you will learn and grow from that. And it is also okay to feel hopeless sometimes. It's okay to, like, look at the scale of humanity and be like, oh, we are still spiraling to mass extinction. Like, we are destroying the only livable planet that we know of that we can survive on. Not to say we're destroying the planet, but we're destroying the conditions that make it favorable for us mm-hmm. to live on. It is okay to hold that really close and also to do what you can. I think about, like, my little blip of existence and the fact that, like, I'm not going to live forever. One day I'll be on my deathbed and I'll be like, like, is there anything I regret? Do I wish I had thought about things differently? Well, probably will still be that, but I just try and think about the actions that we take at a small scale on a broader window of time. Do what you can and look back and don't have regrets about it.
Awesome. Thank you for that. What does a successful future look like to you? I know that's a very scalable question.
Yeah, it is a scalable question.
Whatever question or whatever scale you'd like to approach that at.
You know, I grew up in a household that I recognize in retrospect was, like, entrenched in capitalist thinking. My parents grew up really, like, working hard to make a good living and provide for their kids, which I respect and I appreciate. I mean, I've managed to go to university and build a life for myself because my parents were generous and took care of me. But at the same time, we didn't really critically reflect on, like, what is money? What is success? It was always assumed that your success comes from how much money you make and that you can buy a nice house and travel and blah, blah, blah. I think in our society, we're actually needing to shift away from that model. And people are starting to recognize that our system of capitalism is probably reaching its final chapters, where we just fundamentally cannot sustain this anymore. Not to say we have to stop consuming altogether or we're not going to have money anymore. Of course not. But what defines success for a person is shifting. So I think it's a very personal question for people to figure out what success means for them. I would say at a societal level, we need to shift towards a model of success that emphasizes human well-being. And that includes balance with our environment, balance between the individual and the collective, balance between individual liberty and the greater utilitarian good. And so I think success at that scale is coming. We are going to get there. The question is how soon and what harm happens in the meantime before we make that transition.
Okay. I like that point. What makes you hopeful?
I would say talking to people in general. There is more knowledge and more wealth in the world today than there has ever been. There are more people who care about protecting the environment today than have ever been alive in history. I think what we need to do now is organize them and give them work and consolidate the power that we have. I see a lot of potential that is untapped, and I'd say that gives me hope.
That's awesome. I never thought of that. That's a great thought to, yeah, that's crazy. because environmentalism is rather new.
The environmental movement has been kind of a response to contemporary challenges, but I think there have always been people who were attuned to the environment and cared about trees. I mean, I love birds and I get asked to talk about birds incessantly, but I think people have been paying attention to birds probably before we even had the ability to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. So is that a form of environmentalism? I would say arguably yes, because when you care about birds, then maybe you're choosing to interact with your surroundings differently. Maybe you don't hunt and eat the thing, right? I think environmentalism is more nuanced, though. It's not just a monolith of one movement. Nowadays, there's a lot of talk about looking towards the world's indigenous cultures and recognizing that they've been stewards of land for millennia and have retained this balance. Not to say indigenous peoples have all the solutions for climate change and they're not going to rescue us from, you know, settler colonial problems of our own making, but I think there are values there that we could learn from. And absolutely. Values that need to be integrated into the environmental movement.
Mm-hmm. Okay, last question. Are there any resources that you'd like to share where people can learn more about what we've talked about today?
If you're interested in my work, a lot of it is posted at birdfriendlylondon.ca. So I would check that out. Again, we made a repository of all these resources that people are welcome to adapt and use. So I'd say that's a good place to start. And if you end up there, it might refer you in other directions.
Okay. Awesome. And since I'd just like to add, since your presentation in our class, I've noticed several windows with the bird stickers on them that are just birds. And now I can explain to people why those actually don't work.
I love that. It's very hard to take me anywhere now because I see them and I'm like, there it is. Like,
yeah.
And it usually suggests that someone has tried their best. Like they didn't have access to knowledge, but they noticed a bird crashed into a window and they wanted to do something about it.
Yeah.
I have, again, letters that I slip into people's mailboxes. But yeah, the path to enlightenment for the public is not one that we can really just clear cut our way down and solve the problem right away. It's going to take many incremental conversations and ways of presenting information and getting that out into community. And so, yeah, I appreciate the work that you're doing by having those conversations with your friends.
Yeah, well, hopefully I can share it here too and hopefully share it many more times over.
Yeah, if you're listening and you ever have a bird crash into your window, don't put one or two stickers up on the glass. That does not work. You need to cover the entire window, the pattern, so that the birds will not try and fly around whatever elements that you're using. Instead, it has to appear like this is a solid barrier. So little patterns of dots or lines, you can draw them with a paint marker or tape, work really well. But yeah, if you visit that website, there's lots of suggestions.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Brendan. I really enjoyed our conversation today.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thank you for learning with me today and dedicating your time listening to Vistas and Voices. Time is our most valuable asset, and I'm grateful that you chose to share some of yours with me today. If today's episode struck a chord with you, I'd be honored if you could share it with friends, family, or colleagues who you think would enjoy it too. Every share, particularly those made through personal recommendations, plays a significant role in nurturing our growing community. Furthermore, if you could take a moment to leave a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you tune in, it would be immensely supportive. Your feedback is precious to me. It not only aids in enhancing our content, but it also helps others find our conversations. Please feel free to reach out to me via my website, www.thepursuitproject.org/contact, on Instagram @Tyler_Garwood, or on LinkedIn. Your thoughts, questions, and feedback are always greatly appreciated. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to our next episode, where I'll see you right here on Vistas and Voices.